This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to By the Book today. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me is Sharmila Gunnison. And we are trying to unknot a very tough knot, a Gordian knot today, because we are going to attempt to talk about the issue of canon.
Canon when it comes to literature. And I suppose increasingly as we get so many adjacent products, books, movies, TV shows,
websites,
Instagram accounts that are related to books, what exactly is canon when it comes to literature anymore?
And also, how do we feel about authors tampering with or dabbling in their own canon? Because it used to be, of course, that whatever the author said was canon was canon. It was very simple. Basically, everything that the author did would fall into the main body of the work.
Right.
And then everything else that other people participated in or added on to was sometimes unkindly called fan fiction, sometimes fan contributions, whatever. The point is that fans interacted with canon and created their own art, but the canon stood alone and untouchable. However, I suppose in recent times, as we're seeing more problematic additions or more moments of flawed creators, where you start to see the flaws of the creators poking through in their additions, fans have also reacted by saying, you know what? No, it is just the original 7 books and nothing beyond that. Or it's just the original 3 movies and nothing beyond that. And, you know, the world is not just yours, it's a shared space. And that's been an interesting conversation.
And you say 7 books because clearly we have someone in mind as a great example of how this has panned out. I suppose in a hugely sort of culturally significant way, it is, of course, the Harry Potter series by J.K. Rowling.
Did you ever make anything happen? Anything you couldn't explain? You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
Well, yes, the Harry Potter series, and then also, so earlier we said websites because there's Pottermore. Mm-hmm.
There's also a theme park.
Yes, there's just a lot going on in Potterland, and specifically to how J.K. Rowling has decided to play with this, right? So we've got our 7 books and one questionable epilogue, and then you have...
then there's the play. So the only actual written material that was published was the play, which is Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Which wasn't even written by her.
Technically, she apparently wrote it in collaboration with the ultimate directors of the play. The bound script version has her name on it.
Yes, fair enough. So we have that. Then we have the Fantastic Beasts series, which are primarily movies.
Yes, because the book itself was just a guide to the fantastic creatures.
You're an interesting man, Mr. Scamander. Just like your suitcase, I think there's much more to you than meets the eye. Kicked out of Hogwarts for endangering human life with a beast. Yet one of your teachers argued strongly against your expulsion. I wonder, what makes Albus Dumbledore so fond of you, Mr. Scamander?
We have in this situation, I think, a world where fans lived very happily for a long time, right? Yep. We're a little bit distanced from the hype now of Harry Potter, but I certainly remember midnight lineups and just the immense amount of hype, calling ahead of time to try and secure your book when it came out. It was a phenomenon. It was huge.
Absolutely. And it was one that was relived again and again as each movie came out. And to the extent that I think it became a world that the fans truly, truly inhabited. People knew what they looked like, what they wore, what each person would say. And, you know, J.K. Rowling created that.
It is a world where fans have actually annotated, I think, in their own minds, just remembered what goes where, who is whose parent or uncle or, you know, it's a very, very fully involved world. And then it is one in which J.K. Rowling is retroactively adding to and changing.
Yes.
And I think that has been kind of the main source of conflict and, let's face it, people making fun of her because she's added queerness, for example.
Yeah.
She's added race.
She's added just backgrounds to characters that we didn't know were existent, you know, or which completely changed the way you viewed a particular character.
Yes.
Are we aiming for no spoilers?
Yeah, we should probably clarify. I think we will try our best for no spoilers. That's quite hard to talk about. We'll try our best for no spoilers because there are some things that we can safely say. For example, the big bad before He Who Shall Not Be Named was Grindelwald.
Yeah.
And that guy was always mentioned in the books, but then it turns out, secret lover of Albus Dumbledore, who, you know, in and of itself, not a problem. I'm fine with that. But it's the manner of the addition and the sort of haphazard single sentence addition. That's all she said.
She did it in a tweet, didn't she?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, it was in response to someone asking her, why did Albus Dumbledore never get married? Or have a family, something like that. And she just responded saying, oh, but didn't you know that Dumbledore was gay?
I do feel I have some duty on a personal level as well, because I've always had my own suspicions about this. Dumbledore being gay.
I thought you were going to ask something completely. Yeah, go on.
Dumbledore being gay.
Yeah.
Well, was that something that was just thrown out for the American press to get them stirred up a bit? No.
Though it did.
No, it did, which is obviously very funny. But,
yeah, but I found people's reaction to that really interesting, and I'll tell you why. By the time that I said that, I had been working on these characters for 17 years. Now, not many writers have ever been with the same set of characters for that long, right. So I feel I can sort of speak for all of us who have.
Yeah.
And to say it becomes a very intense experience, and inevitably you are going to know things about characters, and I'm characters in the plural, that are not, in some cases, will be relevant, and you'll think, oh, yeah, this is the moment that becomes relevant, and I will say that or show that.
Right.
For example, Professor McGonagall, I had a whole history worked out for her that I think I thought at some point would become relevant, that she'd had a love affair with a muggle, and that she'd had this quite tortured past, and she ended up being this celibate elderly teacher, never became relevant, never happened. And as time went on and I got to know Dumbledore, but this is before the publication of Philosopher's Stone, so bear in mind, at this point, I've been with him for 7 years, I knew he was gay. I just knew he was gay.
Okay.
And to me, it was not a big deal. This is a very old man who has a very terrible job to do, and his gayness is not really... It's not really relevant. Very relevant to him as a character, because I always saw him as a very lonely character.
And then she doubled down because, of course, people reacted a little. I think there were some people who were understandably happy about it. You know, there was a sense of, oh, some representation, great. But then on the flip side, you had people who go, well, this is cheap representation because it's a tweet, you know, and it wasn't present in the books. And so that goes to that interaction between external additions and canon. Because if you look at canon Dumbledore, there is, in all seven books, no mention of anything aside from a close friendship with Grindelwald. And we are not in Victorian England. We don't need to make these sorts of allusions anymore. I think if you wanted to say something, you could have said it.
So I think for me, when the Dumbledore revelation came out, it didn't strike me as too weird. I was slightly older when I started reading the books.
Yeah.
I was aware that they were children's books when they started, though they evolved to become darker and more adult as they went on. For me, it almost felt like, well, very few other characters' sexualities were openly discussed anyway. Almost none. Basically, they talked about teenage crushes and relationships, but very little about the adults. So for me, that was something that could conceivably have been true. And it didn't bother me very much. But as things went on and she kept retroactively adding these things, then it started becoming, I suppose, a pattern of wanting to keep tinkering with this world that she had created.
And then that speaks to the larger question of who owns canon.
Big question.
It is a big question, because I understand why she's tinkering, because she might see certain omissions, certain flaws that she wants to add. And the logic there would be, this is my world. This is my house. If I want to move a vase, I can do that. If I want to buy a new sofa, I shall. You know, it's my house. I created it. I built it brick by brick. But fans are, of course, saying, yeah, you built it. We've lived here.
Yeah, we've lived here. And we've lived here voluntarily, you know, lovingly. We've walked in in into a space that we thought was already done.
And then here we are.
Yeah. And then now you're changing the tiles in the kitchen to a color I don't like. You know, it's uncomfortable because the world that your brain creates, that imagination creates, you know, you tinker with one thing and everything falls apart. It's weird. It's difficult to explain, I think.
It is. And it's quite a modern problem, which I think you'd mentioned previously, which is this idea that now J.K. Rowling can change everything in a tweet. It used to be that you would write a whole separate book or you'd republish your book with edits.
Yes.
And then maybe someone would notice. maybe people wouldn't with the republication. But now, because you have all these different things supporting the main work, it's just very difficult. And there is a part of me that wants to say we should not pander to the most demanding of fans, because that in and of itself creates a terrible situation where mob rule is not the best way to tell a story. Mm-hmm. The happy ending desired by many is not always the best story that should be told.
Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily want to hit a situation where you have fans basically demanding that the endings of books be changed, because you know what? I own canon now. It's mine.
Yeah.
And we saw that, for example, with Game of Thrones.
Yes, very recently, actually.
Yes, yeah. With the petition that was signed by like half a million people.
Half a million people. Mm. And that's mind-boggling to me. I mean, we've always seen this with, say, Star Wars.
For an entire generation, people have experienced Star Wars the only way it's been possible, on the TV screen. But if you've only seen it this way, you haven't seen it at all.
Now, for its 20th anniversary, the adventure of a lifetime returns to the big screen in a way you've never seen before.
There'll be no one to stop us this time.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
With newly enhanced visual effects.
They're coming in too fast!
THX and digital sound. And a few new surprises.
When George Lucas chose to edit the second edition of the first version of the movies, I forget now. But yes, George Lucas, who is the creator of the Star Wars film universe, got so much criticism when he wanted to redo how he told the story, because fans felt like, well, we own it too. You don't get to change how we've already built this world in our mind.
We would like to hear from you on this, actually. What do you think? Who owns canon? You know, is it going to be the creators or is it the fans? You can WhatsApp us your thoughts, 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio, because clearly we're all fans, we're all in this together. And it is just it's a difficult thing to try and separate and to try and tease out. So get in touch with us. You are listening today to Buy the Book. We're going to continue our conversation after this. BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. Today, we are talking about canon. Dun, dun, dun. We're talking about who owns canon, because we've seen authors and creators. We spoke earlier of J.K. Rowling and George Lucas both having had these retroactive, like, hey, turns out this happened, let's just add that, kind of spirit being brought to their main body of works. And fan reaction's not been great.
No, and I think in addition to that also is something like Game of Thrones, where not only do you have the original books that the writer wrote, we now have the TV show which has completed the story when the author hasn't written the story yet.
How many of you in our studio audience saw Game of Thrones last night? More than 19 million Americans gathered around their televisions last night. It was the most watched episode of anything ever for HBO, ahead of The Sopranos, even ahead of the season finale of Arliss. This was a big, big deal. A lot of Americans.
There's a part of me that wonders whether looking at the fan reaction to the story, whether that would influence how the books end.
Right.
Because that would feel like a betrayal of sorts. I don't know now what I want from this anymore. And I mean, we've been talking about sort of these big tomes, right? These long-running 3-book, 5-book, 7-book kind of...
Yeah, and largely fantasy and those kinds of epic storytelling style books.
Yes, but that's not to say that literary fiction has been without its own problems or has been without its own situations where readers then turn around and say, I don't like this, and I'm rejecting this wholeheartedly. And I'm thinking here of someone to whom this happened actually after death, and it's Harper Lee.
Yes, with Go Set a Watchman, which is a sequel to Kill a Mockingbird.
One of the greatest books of all time.
Absolutely one of my favorite books of all time. But she actually wrote Go Set a Watchman first and then decided not to publish it and then extracted bits of it that eventually became To Kill a Mockingbird.
And then the publication of it happened, I think, many, many, many years after her passing.
Yes.
And there has been a lot of ethical concerns, I think, surrounding even reading the book, right? The idea of whether or not you should read something that the author never intended you to read. So there's a lot going on there. But it does entirely change the characters of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Completely, particularly the character of Atticus Finch.
Yeah.
And Atticus Finch is one of those characters that I think for so many people is such a seminal character in shaping, you know, who they are.
I am confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence that you have heard, come to a decision, and restore this man to his family. In the name of God, do your duty.
I think just sort of an emblem of what it means to be a decent human being standing up for what is right.
Right. And then you find out that he doesn't become old you find out that he wasn't that decent after all, which for me was incredibly painful because, you know, Atticus Finch is a very, very important character for me.
Isn't that a character's right and an author's right? I mean, for somebody who used to be a certain way to then become someone who aged, you know, in sort of an embittered fashion, is that not just a character's right to do so, or the story's right? Because I completely understand where you're coming from, but there's a part of me that reacts in a strong way to the idea that we want to set certain things in stone and never revisit.
No, I get what you're saying. And I think perhaps the challenge with Go Set a Watchman for me was that it almost felt like a cheat. You didn't know there was more to the story. You thought the story was done. This is who they are. And then, you know, decades later, there's this continuation of the story that nobody really wanted. But fair enough, it has a right to exist. I'm not sure. You can tell that I'm so conflicted. So for me, the only way I could deal with the book was to just decide in my head, because I read it. I had to decide in my head, I'm reading about two different characters, two different stories, two different characters, you know, two different Atticuses.
Right.
And that was the only way I could deal with it.
Yeah. Part of it, of course, is we're talking about things that are huge. I think that become iconic characters. All the ones that we've listed so far fall into that category. You know, people now know what it means to say, oh, that's very Harry Potter, or, mm-hmm. you know, wow, that's very Atticus Finch of you. I don't know who's saying these words, but nevertheless.
We do.
Nevertheless, if someone were to say that, you would have a rough idea of what that means. And I think it speaks to the fact that for many of us, characters harden in our heads. Mm-hmm. We read it, we complete it, and once the story is done and there's a bow tied on it, we forever remember Harry as brave. We forever remember Hermione as a genius. We forever remember Ron as third wheel. That's unkind. That is unkind. I recognize that. We remember Ron as, you know, the funny guy. You know,
the best friend.
The best friend. Yeah. The most supportive, despite his own issues of jealousy. See, you know, I can give Ron his due.
There are things about him you like.
I actually really like Ron. I like the Weasley family, but I was just, sorry guys, I was being facetious. So the point is that these people kind of harden, right? They become this is what they are. And then I think the revisiting, that's why it hurts, because it forces you as a reader to do more work. And that is the issue. So something that J.K. Rowling threw off in a tweet mm-hmm. Would then cause a lot of revisiting and reworking of the entire story for many, many readers. It's like, what? So Dumbledore almost turned, and then he didn't turn because of his ex-boyfriend. And it's not, I think, the queerness that is bothersome. It is the fact that you're just adding a whole backstory to somebody that we know their role within the story, because the story has ended.
And it's exactly what you just said, that she just throws it out in a tweet. It has this flippancy to it, which I would argue even a Go Set a Watchman is more acceptable because you have a book, you're reading, you're re-entering this world, and there's effort put into crafting that to evolve the character. A one-line tweet doesn't do that. What it does is just throw an idea at you with very little context and sort of completely changes the direction or the shape of something with not much else.
This is also to do with authors who are still living or who were still living when they created their works, in the case of Harper Lee, of course. But you also have authors who have things continued after their death by others. And I think yes. that is another kind of avenue that we haven't talked about. We have Mario Puzo and The Godfather and his works being taken up after by, I don't even know their names. And then you have Stieg Larsson, of course, who passed away after...
after the third book.
Who are you?
Are you not Lisbeth Salander, the writer of Wrongs? The girl who hurts men, who hurt women.
But of course, then you had The Girl with the Spider's Web, The Girl, you know, and The Girl series are continuing. Yeah. So in that situation, who owns it?
My only experience with that is because I tend to stay away from those books. Because I'm a huge Isaac Asimov fan, I read books that continued his Foundation series. And what they'd done is they had picked on other science fiction writers to sort of write them in their styles as a tribute to him. I didn't like them. And I found them very difficult to get into because the style is different. One can argue that something like the Millennium Trilogy, perhaps because it's so squarely genre fiction. It's also being published now at a time when these things are so much more controlled. There's an effort to match the styles and the usage of words, which is actually very difficult to do.
Yeah.
But often I find it jarring and difficult to get into.
I would just like to throw a quick shout out to Francine Pascal, who, I mean, while we're talking about it being hard to continue people's works, Francine Pascal has turned this into a cottage industry, right? Like, I mean, they're basically...
Hey, Sweet Valley High.
Yeah, but they all read the same. All these books read exactly the same, and they're all written by just... gajillions of people.
Yeah, I remember being so heartbroken when I found that out, that they weren't written by... There was no Francine Pascal. Well, no, there is a Francine Pascal, but she didn't write all of the books.
No, she did not. But that also kind of ties into our conversation, I think, about this idea of what is canon? Because canon only applies to certain books. Nobody looks at Sweet Valley High.
Nobody cares about Sweet Valley High being canon.
No, and yet we say that, but there are canonical things about it. For example, their appearance, which will always appear on like page 6 about, you know, exactly how the twins look, how Lila Fowler looks. There are canonical aspects. It's similar to Archie comics, mm-hmm. right? There are certain things that are set in place and then you can write the story within that. But the point is, if you are going to have a situation where many, many, many cooks are in the kitchen, there are boundaries that have been placed. I don't know if you would call it canon, but I don't see why you wouldn't except for snobbery.
Welcome to Sweet Valley High, where you'll meet identical twins Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield. Both girls are blessed with spectacular good looks. Both wear exactly the same size clothes, but they refuse to dress alike. It isn't easy to tell them apart, but beneath the skin, there is a world of difference. A wicked gleam of mischief lurks in the depths of Jessica's eyes, while Elizabeth's reflect only sincerity.
I agree. I think it has to do with the kind of book that's being published, right? Well, I mean, we do need to wrap up this very large conversation soon. Where do you stand on canon tinkering, I suppose?
I think a lot of it has to do with the intention of the author. I hope it isn't too paternalistic of me to say that I do still respect the role of the creator in the work. I'm cognizant of the fact that without them, I wouldn't have had the works to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that in many ways, these are books that have given me a lot of joy here. I'm thinking specifically about Harry Potter, right? They are J.K. Rowling's children. I respect that. It's the intention of revisiting. Are you doing it because you want to make sure that the next Newt Scamander film has a new plot line in which to follow? Yeah. Are you doing this because you recognize that there were some segments of the fandom that felt really, really left out of your characterization of these characters and you want to say, no, no, look, there are places for you to fit in? That's a different intention. So either way, a lot of it for me comes down to the intention and spirit in which the tinkering is done. I am also somebody who can never, never tire of the Potter world. I reread the books. I love it. they are hugely important to me. If you want to throw me a new snack from time to time about how things are going on in that world, happy to receive it. But how are you doing that?
I agree, because I am probably feeling a little bit more strongly about this than you are, in the sense I do think that once the canon has been created, once it's been written, it should be left alone. But I'm more than happy to read new stories, to read new, you know, even if it's just a short story, a snippet, the kinds of, I love the little bits that she wrote on the Pottermore website outlining the houses in the American School for Magic. So those kinds of things I'm fine with. I don't necessarily like the flippancy of just being able to take something that's already been done and then changing it because, hey, I can, I wrote the books. There seems to be an inherent disrespect towards her fans and her followers, which doesn't sit so well with me.
I get that. I understand that, which is why I think we haven't really discussed The Cursed Child, because The Cursed Child is a piece of art.
Yes,
it's not a tweet.
Yeah, I agree.
So let us know what you think about this. Like we said, it's a tangled subject, but one I think that we both kind of want to resolve, if only so that we can revisit Harry Potter and not feel so torn. What do you think about canon? Who owns it? Are creators allowed to tinker with it whenever they want? WhatsApp us your thoughts. 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. And now we come to footnotes. And since we've spent the bulk of the show really talking about canon and the authority of the author, quote unquote, we thought we needed to take a bit of a flip side approach and look instead at the fans. Fans who write fan fiction, who engage with this work. And thankfully, we have someone in the office who did just that. And that's Christine Wong of Enterprise. Christine, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you write fan fiction, wrote fan fiction?
Wrote fan fiction. Was very heavily involved in a couple of fandoms when I was in my teens.
And what are these fandoms?
Oh gosh. the least embarrassing of which was probably Harry Potter. To this day, still pretty big fan. People know that in the office. But also I was really, the main one that I wrote content for was Glee. Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
You wrote Glee fanfiction.
Oh, yeah. That's, let's let that, you know, percolate for a second.
So when you were writing fanfiction and like actively doing it as a teen, what drew you to it? Was it just that you just didn't want to leave the world behind? You just wanted to be able to participate in it?
Right. So for for Glee specifically, there was a very tight-knit online community, mainly focused on sort of the Tumblr space. And it came out of a real sense of frustration. We were very frustrated with the way that the writers were handling a lot of, not just the topics that they were trying to tackle, but also some of the character development just felt very rushed. And it was one of those things where it was like, because we loved it so much, we wanted to help improve it. And we wanted to help bring those characters and those topics into a space where they could actually grow and flourish, as opposed to seeing them on screen just kind of be in the background and not really discussed or talked about in detail.
So if I could pivot that a little bit to books, because it's a book show.
Yes.
but also because in books, that sense of things not happening the way you want to are not as immediate as a TV show.
Yeah.
So why would you then engage in fan fiction when it comes to literature? Is that a different motivation?
I think it depends on the literature, but also I found that there's a whole variety of kind of exploration that people do with alternate universes. People love taking characters and putting them into different situations and seeing, basically kind of letting them play, right? Like what would they be like in high school? What would they be like in space? What would they be like in a horror film, right? So I think that's really a lot of the appeal, is that because you're so invested in these stories and these characters and you want to see more of them, you want to try and experiment a little bit, you know, and see how that goes. I think also it's notable that with fan fiction, I think a lot of people seem to think that fan fiction is a very, I guess, cult thing, or a very, you know, only certain people are interested in it. But the surprising amount of things I would consider fan fiction. I mean, technically speaking, Paradise Lost was fan fiction, if you want to look at it that way, right? Because let's not lie to ourselves. John Milton looked at the Bible and went, I could do more.
I can develop this.
Right? I'm just going to write like a whole bunch about how Satan is the protagonist of this, which is a whole thing.
Paradise Lost. John Milton's epic poem, adapted by Adrian Mitchell in 41 episodes. With Dennis Quilley as the poet and Ian McDermid as Satan. Episode 1, in which the fallen angel Satan plots with his henchman Beelzebub. But first, the poet states the aim of his poem.
Did any of what you were doing stem from dissatisfaction with the author? Because, I mean, we were speaking a little bit earlier on about, well, primarily focused on J.K. Rowling and her Twitter habits.
Yep.
So did any of, you know, your participation in stories and characters, did it come from a sense of, gosh, you know, like you made up these characters, but at this point, I don't feel like you can be responsible for them anymore.
Yeah, I would say that's actually a really big factor, especially with, I know that for a fact that there are some fandoms out there that really do feel protective of the property. And like, while we do respect, essentially what has been set in canon is usually followed. Like, you know, if a character is, you know, a certain race, a certain characteristics, their base personality gets followed to the T. Mm-hmm. But it's just this feeling of, you know, thank you for introducing it to us. Now let us take it from here because you clearly don't know what you're doing.
But is that, I mean, I'm thinking, is that a thing though? Because they are the creator.
Yeah, there is that debate.
Do they not know what they're doing?
So this is the thing. I think it depends, again, like, I personally separate the two things. I'm not one of those people that writes that much because I'm mad at the author. It's more for me, like, well, when I used to anyway. It was more just because I was always curious about, well, what more can we do? But there are some people who get genuinely angry because they feel that there's a lot of wasted potential. But then it's also, then there's also the argument of, like you said, right? If the author feels like that's enough, that should be enough.
Yeah, and I think that there's a whole separate conversation to be had here, and one that we probably should have started with, which is, what do you consider canon? Because you said earlier that, you know, when you kind of take the character on, the base traits kind of stick around. It's the other things that tend to develop. So what do you consider canon? So, for example, with Harry, his parents, you know, his origin story, so to speak, is that immovable? Is that, you know, we can't shake that?
Yeah. That I would say is pretty set in stone. Again, with fan fiction, you know, basically when you write something like that, there are always sort of categories or tags that you put on it to establish, like, because sometimes you do just ignore that and then you will establish, like, okay, this is like one where Harry's parents did not die, for example. Mm. But you make that very clear. So that would be what I would be considered canon. Things like that are on Pottermore is technically canon, but we kind of call that like outside or external canon. It's just extra stuff. Mm. The books and also to an extent what the movies are doing, that is like pure canon.
So we can't budge from, say, Ginny.
I feel like
you had to go and do that. So with that, for example, right, in terms of characters, then you kind of have to separate that. Are you talking about book Ginny canon? Are you talking about movie Ginny canon? Because those are almost two separate characters. Some people might fight me on this, but
no, I don't think so. I think
yes, most of us are on the same page.
Yeah. So then you have to think about, you know, what is the source of that, right? And who made what decisions? Because I think you could argue, for example, that book Ginny is J.K. Rowling's sort of canon. And then you can argue that movie Ginny is like whoever directed it's canon.
So when you read fan fiction, you know, whether your own or the ones that others have written.
I don't read my own, thank you.
I wouldn't either. My own, I mean, not yours. But do you derive the same satisfaction from reading fan fiction set in this world that you so obviously love as you do from the canon?
I think it depends on what I'm looking for, you know. And what surprised me when I first started getting into fan fiction and fandom is how well written some of the stories are, which sounds kind of funny, but you'd be surprised at how many people have really put so much talent and effort into creating a really interesting narrative, sometimes to the point where I've forgotten that the characters in it were part of anything else. And that, I think, is, it's not the same kind of enjoyment, but it's a nice, a sort of alternative form of enjoyment and of seeing, you know, what people can do when they are given these resources.
All right. So in closing then, I think Sharmila and I circled this point and we never really landed on anything because I think we just, it's a huge tangled issue. Are you cool with authors writing their own fan fiction fundamentally, you know, in some ways where they revisit it and they're like, you know what, just going to dismantle it and go for it again. Are you cool with authors tinkering that way?
I think that I am cool with authors tinkering. I think what it boils down to, though, is, you know, do the authors understand, especially when it is something that has been culturally impactful, do they understand what impact their work has had? And are they kind of following that line of thought, or are they completely ignoring that? I think that there is, while obviously it is the author's prerogative, they also have to understand the impact that they've had on people and the impact that their stories have had on people. And if they divert from that, be prepared to expect some backlash.
And on that note, let us know what you think about fan fiction. Let us know what you think about canon. Again, you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write us buythebook at bfm.my. You've been listening today to Buy the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.